Part 5 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology, a teaching on non-hatred with Jack Kornfield.
The painter Georges Braque wrote at one point, he said, "Art is a wound turned to light," speaking of transformation, to take that which is difficult and turn it into something of value. Now, we talked about the strategy of grasping, greed, the grasping self, the addictive self, the compulsive self, and how when we understand that, if we pay attention to the story that it tells, to the hole inside us, to the emptiness, to the sensations that come with it, if we really listen and see it for what it is, that attention can lead us to a discovery of space that contains all things, a sense of wholeness or inner abundance or richness of heart. If we listen to that longing and ask, what is it we really long for? We can discover something else, not the objects of our longing, but something deeper. So Gil Fronsdale, who teaches here and is a friend, spoke the other day about being in Morocco when he was 19, traveling in the Sahara. And he said he and his friends went way out in the desert, and they came to a small and ancient village at an oasis and stayed for several days as the guests there, as one does in those Arab cultures or those North African cultures, Islamic culture, I should say. And each day that they stayed, just as the moon would rise in the evening, carpets would be rolled out around where the water was in the oasis, and they were feasted. And he said, at first it felt like we were royalty, that we were, you know, the visiting prince or princess of some other domain. We were just so beautifully taken care of. And then he said, as he reflected about it for some days, he realized that no, they were like royalty, that those who offered the food and rolled out the carpets and made this banquet were really the kings and queens, that that place of generosity is the royalty in ourselves. In delusion and doubt, confusion, we'll talk more about that, denial being spaced out. If we learn to pay attention, to stay present with that in our body and heart, it too can be transformed and can lead us to openness, to spaciousness. Instead of being spaced out, there can be space. And seeing what's so, there can be clarity. For this evening, going back to the root of aversion, ill will, hatred, aggression, the aggressive self, the angry self, the judgmental self, all those states that arise to push the world away, criticism, fear. So that is the strategy that when we enter a room, we see what's wrong with it. When we enter a situation, we see what we don't like. And it's not just small things, although we can observe it all day long in different ways. Criticism, judgment, dislike, aversion, pushing away. But it can then escalate and become really terrible. So that, for example, in Cambodia, three Khmer Rouge guerrillas dined pleasantly with UN peacekeepers before opening fire at the end of the meal and killing the three in what the United Nations called a cold-blooded execution. The method was reminiscent of earlier Khmer Rouge times in the 1970s purges, when cadres considered to be traitors were called to the capital for meetings, feted with banquets and gifts, and then surprised with an execution at the end of the meal. Basically, says one Buddhist teacher, hell seems to be related with ultimate aggression. Aggression that is based on such perpetual hatred that you begin to lose the point, You're uncertain as to whom you're building up your aggression toward or by whom your aggression is being built up. There's this continual process of uncertainty and confusion and pain. Not only that, but you begin to build up a whole environment of aggression until the world around you becomes like yourself. So this is one of the attitudes that can grow out of this body of fear. And it comes from territorial quality, ownership, the guard dog inside. The sense of self, my way, my ideas, how things should be, our will. We know the right way. You know what's right and wrong, don't you, and how things should be. Know that state? My ideas, my views. A storekeeper heard one of his salesmen say to a customer, "No, ma'am, we haven't had any for some weeks now, and it doesn't look like we'll be getting any soon." Horrified at what he was hearing, he rushed over to the customer as she was walking out and said, "That isn't true, ma'am. Of course we'll have some soon. In fact, we placed an order for it just a few days ago." Then he drew his employee, the salesman, aside and growled angrily at him, "Never, never, never say that we don't have something. If we don't have it, say we've ordered it and it's on the way. Now, what was it that she wanted?" "Rain," said the salesman. Not very far-fetched, that story, really, if you look. As we practice and develop the quality of attention or mindfulness, we can observe how and when does the stories that we have and the beliefs and what we do, how it feels when we get into our positions against the world and what the results are. We can pay attention. In our own lives, we can see how often the state of aversion, judgment, anger, aggression comes as a response to the inevitable disappointments of life. Betrayals, sorrow, pain, and loss. Who in this room has not been betrayed sometime or other? In many ways, we have. Disappointment is one of the words that's a proper translation for the first noble truth of the Buddha in this psychology, sometimes called dukkha, the noble truth of suffering. But disappointment is maybe a better word. Even beautiful things fade or change or are lost. Disappointments in our own body. Disappointments because the madness of our life leaves us too busy to parent our own children. Or love one another in the ways that we want, or be loved. Disappointment for the injustices in the society that are so apparent we can almost not stand it. Or in the world, warfare and hunger. And even if we want somehow to do something about it, there's this frustration, it seems out of control. Personal and global. So what do we do with this disappointment, betrayal, the pain that's around us? Do we stuff it? Okay, I won't get angry and I won't be upset. You know, I'll take it easy. I'll be peaceful, new age maybe. But then you kind of get like neutered spiritual people, right? Spayed. That's worse, I think, you know. Really, isn't it? One of the problems in our society is that we have not learned to distinguish uncertainty from anxiety. There is betrayal and there is uncertainty and there's pain and so forth. Those are the facts. Then our fear and our aggression, our response to it is something else. So what do we do? When we study the mind and heart and body, we can notice in the attempts we have to control life with our aggression and judgment and so forth, the contraction in it, the fear in it, and the pain in those attempts. It's as if we create a cage for our heart. It's an old saying, a bird in a cage will forget how to sing. And within that cage in ourselves, the same can be true. So how else might we respond to sorrow, injustice, to fear? Imagine in yourself for a minute a past situation of difficulty, you all have them, that evoked anger, judgment, hatred, all those things. Remember one? Think of one. Sure. And sense in the evoking of that anger and hatred and aversion and judgment, sense with that the fear that was there or the pain that underlay it, the contraction. And then in this moment, center yourself and sense if there's any other possibility in responding to that. As we bring a mindful presence and attention to our life, and particularly to this dimension, we can begin first by acknowledging or naming. There's the critical voice. Oh yeah, we talked about that. Where you learned it. Whose name it is, who taped it in there. There's the angry dog. There's the hurt and betrayal and all the responses to it inside ourselves. So we can acknowledge it. And then we can sense, as it arises, the fear of loss, the pain that creates that contraction. And if you listen carefully at that point in the inner process, if you pay attention, you can see a wonderful truth about it, because it's not all bad. That is, that judgment or anger or aggression or aversion really stems out of a kind of love. A love for ourself, a self-protection, a caring. It seeks some kind of strength or protection or justice for what seems wrong in that situation. It's just a painful strategy to do it. Doesn't work so well. If you lose your own peaceful center and are overwhelmed by the force of circumstance and others, by their perceptions and feelings generated by the externals, then your own mind will have no independence, no freedom or peace, and you will be functioning inwardly in the terms of a slave. You'll be a slave to what other people do and to the changing circumstances that are the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows that keep changing. So we want protection, love, strength, justice. Is there another way, this psychology asks, another way we can touch the betrayal, the loss, another way we can respond? And the other possibility is to touch that which is painful or fearful with compassion, with the Buddha heart within us. Remember, I read this and it seems fitting to read again. If there has been a consistent criticism of Nelson Mandela over the years, it is that he's too willing to see the good in people. If this is a flaw, it's one he accepts, because it grows out of his great strength, his generosity of heart toward even his enemies. He defends himself by noticing that thinking too well of people sometimes makes them behave better than they otherwise would. He believes in the essential goodness of the human heart, even though he has spent a lifetime suffering the wounds of heartless authorities around him. So this other way, which has a tremendous kind of dignity to it, I think, with Nelson Mandela, both of dignity and the fact that he was raised in a culture that still had some roots in what was indigenous and close to the earth, a kind of ancient way of knowing and being. I had an experience in a funny way of that this last week. I took my daughter Caroline's class with some other parents and teachers. Actually, her whole school went to the zoo. And fortunately, one of the people who sits here and part of the community at Spirit Rock, who works at the zoo, invited us to come, and she would give us some special kind of talks or attention there. She has for 17 years been one of the caretakers for the orangutans, the chimpanzees, and the gorillas. And so she kind of introduced us to her family there, which they are after all those years. And we went to see the orangutans, and the big male was inside. She called, "Come on, Rusty, come out. There's people I want you to meet," you know. And he came out hearing her voice and whatever. And she talked about them for a bit and what she fed them. One of their favorite foods in hot afternoons is she whips up watermelon and cantaloupe and other kinds of fruit and then freezes it and gives them fruit pops in the afternoon, which they really like. She said she even once gave them some donuts, and they were thrilled. They like junk food like the rest of us. But anyway, so we went to see the orangutans. We went to the chimpanzees, and the main leader in that family group that we went to see was an older male chimpanzee. And when we all came up close, this whole group of adults and kids and making a lot of noise the way kids do, he kind of got defensive and he stood up, and he's pretty big, you know, and he's kind of standing up on his feet. He was almost as big as I am, or quite a good sized being. Was kind of making sounds and didn't want that many people coming make that noise so close. And she said, you know, if you really want to have a relationship with him and with them, you have to approach more respectfully. And she said, so that he knows that you're not coming trying to do harm to him or the other beings that he lives with. She said, you want to know how you would do that more respectfully, or you can talk about it? She said, you can lower your eyes, or you can kind of bow over a little bit. If you kind of hunch down a little bit, then he knows that you're not coming in an aggressive way. Or he can turn your back to him a little bit, you know. So she said, let's try it. So the kids kind of bowed down or lowered their eyes or turned their backs. And let's see what happens. And as soon as we did it, he got down from that stance he was in and kind of softened and looked kind of curiously and then went about his business. And it was as if we had let him know it was okay. We weren't coming in an aggressive fashion, and he responded. Then we went over to the gorillas. And near where we came was the largest gorilla, this big, wonderful silverback, who was the head of that particular family group. And so we were getting ready all to come up to the gorillas. And there are lots of kids in the zoo and so forth. And the gorillas don't pay much attention to people generally there. She said if she could change the zoo around, the first thing she would do would be to raise the areas where the animals are so that they were above where the people are. So the relationship would be a respectful one. And the animals would know that people were coming to see them, and they could choose whether to relate or when they needed their privacy and so forth. It would be more a proper relationship with someone's home where they live. Anyway, so we went up to where the gorillas were, and she said to the kids, you want to know how to approach a gorilla? You know, that's like some joke, right, for the third graders or something. But she said, again, you do it respectfully. And so she said, the way you do it is, again, you don't kind of stand up and stare, but you kind of lower yourself a little bit, you know. And then she said, the proper noise to make is to kind of clear your throat like you're about to speak. And when you do that, then the gorilla knows someone has something to say to them, and they'll pay attention. So we all kind of walked up to the bar there, and he wasn't paying any attention. All these kids were going by and all these things happening in the zoo, and we got up close, and we all went, and he looked up like, yes, you wanted something? And it was a fantastic moment. It was like, oh, the first word in gorilla language that was respectful that got some response, a very different way of approaching. She said, and if you want to learn about them, she said, forget about teaching them sign language. You can learn their language. She said, my chimpanzees have a word, a sound that they make that I only hear when a blimp goes overhead in the zoo. No other time but that time do they make this particular sound. So there's this sense of another way of approaching life, even if it's a big gorilla, with a kind of attention, heartfelt attention, and respect for what's there. Now, when we study our fearful being, our critical, the angry man or woman within us, we have to also approach that part of us, which is painful, to touch that and the sorrows that are contained within it with respect. And if we do and pay attention, we discover that we are reactive, afraid, need the support, when we are identified with our weakness, with our small self, our small story. When we seek safety in this limited way, then we get all defensive. We seek strength, support with words, with our body, with weapons. And it'll escalate from that place of fear till at its most extreme and very, very common in the world, where people kill one another. And the people who have the most power in this world, in one dimension, are those who aren't afraid to kill others and get weapons and other people to kill others with them. And that's where they have their power and their strength, and they run a lot of the world. So this is the escalation of that feeling afraid and territorial to its extreme. There are two great forces in the psyche: that of fear, contraction, and that of love, which is really the only match to that force. Those who are not afraid to kill, and those who are not afraid to die. That's the other great force in the world. Suppose within us, rather than territoriality, contraction, fear, there were another source of strength and support. There is the earth that holds us, the sky, the air we breathe, our own breath, that which has given us life. There happens in this psychology, or there's a description in this psychology, of a shift from aggression and hatred to non-hatred or love, that comes when our identity changes from being that small self, body of fear, to resting in that which is timeless, the great heart of our own Buddha nature. To remembering in a moment of attention our own spirit, or resting in some greater truth than the little things that are there in the moment, or even difficult ones that upset us. This is from Thomas Traherne. You never enjoy the world aright till the sea itself flows in your veins, till you are clothed with the heavens and crowned with the stars, and perceive yourself to be the sole heir of the whole world, till your spirit fills the whole world and the stars are your jewels, till you are as familiar with the sacred as with your own walk and table, till you are intimately acquainted with that shady nothing out of which the world was made, till you love others so as to desire their happiness with a thirst equal to the zeal of your own. There is another source of strength and support, and that's there all the time. It's the moon that came, and the earth, and our breath, and this power of life that creates all the things that we know, that's there in a moment of our deep attention. And from this place, from this releasing of the story and he did and she did, to something greater, there comes a quality, Gandhi called it soul force, that belongs to those who are so in touch with life and love and what it really is that they aren't afraid to die. And it has a tremendous beauty. And we all have our moments of it. The images that I carry with me of this is that cellist who used to go out in the square in Sarajevo in the afternoons in spite of the shelling and the sniping and play his cello for the people of the city in the face of all of that. And what an incredible thing to do. And he did it every day for months and months. Or the mothers in Argentina who dressed in black and marched in the plaza during the worst years of the dictatorship. Every week, again and again and again. Do you know what? There are mothers who dress in black now in Croatia and Zagreb and go out in the square and walk for the sorrows of their children, and they do it every week in the same way, no matter what happens. Soul force. And this isn't small. It's great. And it's a good thing because the injustices in our cities and between nations, homelessness, racism, tribalism in the world are great. Thich Nhat Hanh has a book of his poetry from 1966 he wrote. I just do not know why they hurl grenades at these young people, his friends. Why kill boys still innocent, girls with ink-stained hands? What was their crime? To hear the voice of compassion, to come and teach the children to work in the rice paddies? We accept death and sorrow of 12 of our friends. But listen, the grenades that have burst apart their bodies are caught in the heart of life. They remain still. Come, hear me, for time grows short and danger is everywhere. Let us take those grenades out of our hearts, our motherland, out of humankind. Let us stand side by side and walk in the cool morning together. To awaken to this true nature, to discover this true heart, allows us to pay any price or bear any burden, those kind of phrases. It's not the same as avoiding conflict. Gandhi, remembered, somebody asked him about nonviolence, and he said, nonviolence is not passivity, and it's not the same as cowardice. He said, if I had to choose between violence and cowardice, I would choose violence every time. He said, it's not cowardice at all. It's a greater strength than violence to enter the world in that way. Cesar Chavez, when we're really honest with ourselves, we must admit that our lives are all that belong to us. So it's how we use our lives that determines their value. What kind of person we are. It's my deep belief that only by giving our lives do we find life. I'm convinced that the truest act of courage is to sacrifice ourselves for others. To be human is to willingly suffer for the well-being of others. God help us to be human. So we're not talking about weakness, but from a deeper place of strength, from stillness and emptiness and wholeness. For a disciple of the Buddha who is freed, in whose heart dwells peace, there's nothing to be added or taken away from this moment. Just as a rock of one great mass remains unshaken by the wind, even so, neither forms nor sounds, tastes or odors, neither the desired nor the undesired, can cause their heart to waver, steadfast is their being, gained is freedom or deliverance. When we find this stillness in ourself, then there can come a response which connects our wisdom and compassion together, a knowing that we all have our own inner knowing, a nakedness and openness, truthfulness, and a kindness. Love is patient. Wisdom is patient and kind and strong. We pray for the power to be gentle, the strength to be forgiving, the patience to be understanding, and the endurance to accept the consequences of holding to what we believe is right in this earth. So as we sit, we can discover that place in ourselves. And it's a shift of identity. Stepping out of the thoughts and fears that create the small sense of self. When you discover that place, if you pay attention, if you discover that anger, judgment and those things are always a reaction. And that this place of Buddha nature is not in reaction to anything. It's not even in relation to something. We seek strength, but strength isn't that you can beat away something or fight against something. Most fundamentally, strength is our being, is our connection with life, with the earth. And it's just here, not for or against anything. It's nothing to do with anything else. It is our being present fully in this moment. And this true strength, which untangles the mistaken qualities of aggression and anger and judgment, rests on three qualities. First, it rests on a ground of truth. It is clear-eyed. That's part of the beauty of anger, actually, is that often it sees clearly. So too does this inherent strength of being. In spiritual life, and what the Buddha taught, was often the opposite of what was said around him. And I think in a consumer society, you see it all the time. That there isn't a lot of truth spoken. Remember that from Dwight Eisenhower. Every gun that's made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from all those who hunger and are not fed, from those who are cold and not clothed. This world in arms, which has continued trillions of dollars, is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. This is not a way of life in any true sense. Under a cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. So this strength rests on truth, the willingness to see what's so and speak the truth about our world, its sorrows, its disappointments, and the truth that our work and our life is to seek justice. Whether we succeed or not isn't even the point. As Thomas Merton said, do not depend on hope of results. You may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless and even achieve no result at all, if not even results opposite to what you expect. As you get used to this idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the value, the rightness, the truth of what you do for itself. Can you hear that? That's the place. It's the opposite. That's really resting in truth. This true strength rests in truth. It also is healing. It rests on our boundless capacity to face sorrow and love and forgive anyway. True strength seeks justice, but never puts anyone out of our hearts. I'll tell you a story a friend told me this last week. It's actually a joke. She's a recovering Catholic, she describes herself as. Actually, she's still a Catholic in many ways, in beautiful ways. Anyway, this is a story of Jesus in heaven, and Jesus was wandering around heaven looking at his domain. And as he was wandering on this day, he noticed he came across a number of people who were gambling. And he became a bit upset by this. And then he wandered along further, and he saw some people who were drinking. And he thought, this has really gone too far. I mean, this is heaven after all. So he kind of marched over to the gate and beckoned to St. Peter. He said, sit him down and say, I want to have a talk with you. He said, you know, your job here, as I understand it at this gate, is to see who's ready for heaven, right? And if they're not ready, then they need to spend some time in purgatory and to prepare themselves for this place. St. Peter said, absolutely, that is my job. He said, well, I've been wandering around and there's some people in here who don't look like they are prepared for this place. And they, you know, I think you haven't been careful enough in screening the applicants, right, or who comes in or whatever it is. And St. Peter said, yeah, it's a problem. I'm trying to take care of it as best I can. And Jesus said, well, you know, you have to be careful. I've run into people who were gambling here in heaven, others who were drinking over there. And you know, what's the matter with you? This is your job. Can't you do it properly? You know Jesus, right? I don't know. This is just a joke, remember? It's just a joke. And St. Peter said, well, I'm doing the best I can when they come. I really am trying to follow the rules and screen people carefully. He said, but actually that's not the problem. Jesus said, well, what is the problem? St. Peter said, the problem is your mother. I turn him away and she keeps letting him in the back door. True strength seeks justice, but never puts anyone out of our hearts. It's like Mary at the back door saying, no matter what you've done in some way, I can't turn you away. I too carry you. I make a space for you in my heart. So it says in the Bhagavad Gita, if you want to see the heroic, look for those who can forgive. If you want to see the brave, look for those who can return love for hatred. Read you about the Dalai Lama. Speaking of my own experience, he says, I sometimes wonder why a lot of people like me. When I think about it, I cannot find in myself any special good quality, except maybe for one small thing. He said, that is the positive mind which I try to explain to others and do my best to develop. Of course, there are moments when I do get angry, but in the depth of my heart, I do not hold a grudge against anyone. I cannot pretend that I'm really able to practice this great practice of the bodhicitta of the pure heart, but it does give me inspiration. Deep inside, I realize how valuable and beneficial it is, that's all. And I try as much as possible to consider others more carefully, more important than even myself. I think that's why people take note of me and like me, because of my good heart, maybe. When people say that I've worked a lot for peace, I feel embarrassed. I feel like laughing. I don't think I've done very much for world peace. It's just that my practice is the peaceful path of kindness, compassion, not harming others. This has become part of me. It's not something for which I have specially volunteered. I'm simply a follower of the Buddha, and the Buddha taught that patience is the supreme means for transcending the sufferings of the world, a patient heart. He said, if a monk harms others, he is not a monk. I'm a Buddhist monk, so I try to follow this practice. When people think this practice is something unique and special and call me a leader of world peace, I feel almost ashamed. So truth strength rests on speaking the truth for its own sake. True strength rests on the boundless capacity of our hearts to love and forgive anyway. And true strength rests in emptiness, openness, a receptivity, a flexibility. All martial arts, all painting, all love, all creativity understand this, that things come out of nothing, that there is a place of spaciousness that brings harmony in the world. And when we rest in this moment in what is timeless, there comes a kind of knowing, being. What we seek in anger and judgment and so forth, that is justice, safety, well-being, is already here in us. We contain it. We rest in it already. How sad that people ignore the near and search far for the truth. Like someone in the midst of water crying out in thirst, or a child in a wealthy home wandering lost and poor. All of you by nature are the Buddha, as ice is by nature water. Apart from water, there is no ice. And apart from beings, that's you, there is no Buddha. So what we seek is not far away. It's here whenever we open, in this openness, silence, selflessness, emptiness, just a moment of not thinking, of paying attention, of being present. We all come together. Being nothing, I am everything. Emptiness and love, you could say, are two sides of the same coin. In our culture, love is seen as a weakness. You're loving, you're weak. But it's not a weakness. It's really a connection to our true strength. And love is devoted to life. It loves life. It never gives up hope. Whether it's mothers who care for their children in difficulties, or those who care for the rainforest, or the species disappearing, or just one person. So the practice of the heart and of Buddhist psychology is a fundamental inner shift from territory and grasping, from the body of fear, to trust, to letting go, to the ease of the heart, to forgiveness, to resting in that which was before we were born and after we die, that's not afraid of death. And when we release ourselves, we release others. When we release that which is greater. Remember that story of the prisoner of war, many years later visited a fellow who had been in prison with him and said, "Have you forgiven your captors yet?" And the second man said, "No, never." And the first one said, "Well, then they still have you in prison, don't they?" When we release within ourselves, we release others. The Buddha says, "Look how he abused me and beat me. He threw me down and robbed me." Continue such thoughts and you live in hate. Look how he abused me, beat me, threw me down and robbed me. Abandon such thoughts and live in kindness. You too shall pass away, knowing this. How can you quarrel? In a way, we could say that life is this amazing school to remember or awaken to our wholeness, our connectedness, what we took birth to learn. And so the question is, can we see from this place of our Buddha nature with truth and honesty? Can we find forgiveness? Can we rest in our body and heart and love in the midst of it this world as it is and work for what we value, but rest in that knowing that's before and after all of our actions. Do not depend on the hope of results. As you get used to this notion, you start more and more to concentrate not on results, but on the value, the rightness, the truth of the work itself, of what you do from your own knowing. And so this attention that we bring is to remember that and to discover the freedom that is in that true being, that authentic connection to yourself, to your Buddha nature. And as a kind of blessing, let me read you the benefits that come from awakening the loving kindness and compassion that are there as your own true nature. When your heart of a Buddha rests in this moment and opens, your dreams become sweet. You fall asleep more easily and waken contented. Your health is better, and angels love and protect you. And men and women will love you as well if you're interested in that. It says in this text that when the heart of loving kindness and the great Buddha heart opens within you, weapons won't harm you, poisons won't work. And if you lose things, they will be returned to you. You'll have a beautiful rebirth. People will welcome you everywhere. Your thoughts become pleasant, and animals will sense your kindness and love you, and elephants will bow just a little bit as you walk by. It says, you can try it in the zoo. Your voice will become sweeter, and your babies will be happier in your womb and growing up. And as you develop this sense of loving kindness and trust, if you fall off a cliff, a tree will always be there to catch you. Your countenance becomes serene, and the world becomes peaceful around you, and you become like the Buddha, touching every being that you meet.
This concludes part 5 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology. Please turn the tape over for part 6.